Greenhouse floods forced her family from their Manhattan penthouse. They moved to their summer house in Colorado and found that it was now a lakeside property. Father made it their permanent domicile. Laura had been only a baby then, but she vaguely remembered the shooting out in the woods at night, the strangers who camped on Father's acreage and had to be rooted out by the National Guard soldiers, the angry shouts and sometimes a scream that silenced all the birds momentarily. By and large, though, life was pleasant enough. Her father taught her how to shoot both rifles and pistols, and he always made certain that one of the guards accompanied Laura whenever she went out into the lovely green woods. At school in Boulder, her friends said she led a charmed life. Nothing unhappy ever seemed to happen to her. She was bright, talented, and pleasant to everyone around her. Laura knew that she was no beauty. Her eyes were nice enough, a warm, gold-flecked amber, but her lips were painfully thin, and she thought her teeth much too big for her slim jaw. She was gangly. Her figure hardly had a curve to it. Yet she had no trouble dating young men. They seemed attracted to her like iron filings to a magnet. She thought it might have been her money, although her mother told her that as long as she smiled at young men, they would feel at ease with her. The most popular men on campus pursued her. Victor Molina, dashing and handsome, became her steady beau, until Molina introduced her to a friend of his, an intense, smoldering young engineer named Mance Bracknell. "He's interesting," Laura said. "Mance," Molina scoffed. "He's a weirdo, not interested in anything except engineering. I think I'm the only friend he has on campus." Another student warned, "You know engineers. They're so narrow-minded they can look through a keyhole with both eyes." Yet she found Bracknell fascinating. He was nowhere near handsome, she thought, and his social skills were minimal. He dressed carelessly. His meager wardrobe showed he had no money. Yet he was the only male in her classes who paid no attention to her. He was far too focused on his studies. Laura saw him as a challenge at first. She was going to make him take his nose out of his computer screen and smell the roses. That semester, she and Molina shared only one class with the young engineering student, a mandatory class in English literature. Bracknell was struggling through it. Laura decided to offer her help. "I don't need help," Bracknell told her matter-of-factly. "I'm just not interested in the material." Not interested in Keats? Or Shakespeare? She was shocked. With an annoyed little frown, Bracknell replied, "Are you interested in Bucky Fuller or Raymond Loewy?" She had never heard of them. Laura made a deal with him. If he paid attention to the literature assignments, she would sign up for a basic science class. Molina was not pleased. "You're wasting your time with Mance. For God's sake, Laura, the guy doesn't even wear socks." It took most of the semester for her to penetrate Bracknell's self-protective shell. Late one night, after they had walked from one end of campus to the other as he flawlessly, if flatly, recited Keats's entire poem, The Eve of St. Agnes, to her, Bracknell finally told her what his dream was. It took her breath away. "A tower that goes all the way up into space? Can it be built?" "I can do it," he answered, without an eye blink's hesitation. He wanted to build a tower that rose up to the heavens, an elevator that could carry people and cargo into orbit for mere pennies per kilogram. "I can do it," he told her time and again. "I know I can. The big problem has always been the strength-to-weight ratio of the materials, but with buckyball fibers, we can solve that problem and build the blasted thing." His enthusiasm sent Laura scurrying to her own computer to learn what buckyball fibers might be and how a space elevator could be built. Her friends twitted her about her fascination with the geek. Molina fumed and sulked, angry that she was paying more attention to Bracknell than to him. "How is he in bed?" Molina growled at her one afternoon as they walked to class together. "Not as good as you, Victor dear," Laura replied sweetly. "I love him for his mind, not his body." And she left him standing there in the autumn sunshine, amidst the yellow aspen leaves that littered the lawn. It took months, but Lara realized at last that she was truly and hopelessly in love with Mance Bracknell and his dream of making spaceflight inexpensive enough so that everyone could afford it. Even before they graduated, she used her father's connections to introduce Bracknell to industrialists and financiers who had the resources to back his dream. Most of them scoffed at the idea of a space elevator. They called it a skyhook and said it would never work. Bracknell displayed a volcanic temper, shouting at them, calling them idiots and blind know-nothings. Shocked at his eruptions, Lara did her best to calm him down, to soothe him, to show him how to deal with men and women who believed that because they were older and richer, they were also wiser. It took years, years in which Bracknell supported himself with various engineering jobs, traveling constantly, a techno-vagabond moving from project to project. Lara met him now and then, while her parents prayed fervently that she would eventually get tired of him and his temper and find a young man more to their liking, someone like Victor Molina. Although she occasionally saw Molina as he worked towards his doctorate in biology, she found herself thinking about Bracknell constantly during the months they were separated. Despite her parents, she flew to his side whenever she could. Then he called from Ecuador, of all places, so excited she could barely understand what he was saying. An earlier attempt at building a space elevator in Ecuador had failed. Probably it had been a fraud, a sham effort aimed at swindling money from the project's backers. But the government of Ecuador wanted to proceed with the project, and a consortium of European bankers had formed a corporation to do it, if they could find an engineering organization capable of tackling the job. "They want me!" Bracknell fairly shouted, his image in Lara's phone screen so excited she thought he was going to hyperventilate. "They want me to head the project!" "In Ecuador?" she asked, her heart pounding. "Yes, it's on the equator. We've picked a mountaintop site." "You're really going to do it?" "You bet I am. Will you come down here?" "Yes," she answered immediately. "Will you marry me?" The breath gushed out of her. She had to gulp before she could reply. "Of course I will." But Bracknell's tower had collapsed, killing millions. He was disgraced, tried for mass homicide, exiled from Earth forever. And now, Lara Tierney Molina, married to Bracknell's best friend, mother of their 8-year-old son, rode a shabby freighter to Mercury to be with her husband. Yet she still dreamed of Mance Bracknell.
Goethe Base. As soon as the technicians peeled him out of the cumbersome spacesuit, Molina grabbed his sample box and rushed to the makeshift laboratory he had squeezed into the bare little compartment that served as his living quarters at Mercury Base. From the equipment box that blocked the compartment's built-in drawers, he tugged out the miniature diamond-bladed saw. Sitting cross-legged on the floor, he wormed the safety goggles over his eyes, tugged on a pair of sterilized gloves, then grabbed one of the rocks out of his sample box and immediately began cutting micro-thin slices out of it. He got to his knees and lifted out the portable mass spectrometer from his equipment box. Despite Mercury's low gravity, it was so heavy he barely was able to raise it clear of the box. "Portable is a relative term," he muttered as he looked around for an electrical outlet. The spectrometer's laser drew a lot of power, he knew. "So what if I black out the base?" he said to himself, almost giggling as he plugged the thick power cord into a wall outlet. His quarters were hardly a sterile environment, but Molina was in too much of a hurry to care about that. "I'll just work on a couple of the samples and save the rest for the lab up in Himawari," he told himself. "Besides," he reasoned, "these samples are fresh from the site. There hasn't been enough time for any terrestrial organisms to contaminate them." Time meant nothing now. Hours flew by as Molina sawed sample micro-slices from the rocks and ran them through the spectrometer. When he got hungry or sleepy, he popped cognitive enhancers and went back to work revitalized. "Wish I had brought the scanning, tunneling microscope here," he thought. For a moment he considered asking Alexios if there was one in the base, but he thought better of it. I've got one up in the ship, he told himself. Be patient. But patience